I can tell it might be a night when I stumble. I was about to call it the Epistle of Daniel. That's almost as bad as, say, the Gospel of Romans. But, you know, I'm looking for the book. It's right after, can you find it? It's right after Ezekiel, third chapter. Daniel was taken into captivity with his partners in, just not, with some of the other rulers, the leadership youth of Jerusalem in particular. In other words, those are the noble families. They were selected to be trained in Babylon to eventually be representatives of Babylon. So Babylon's thing was they would, first of all, kind of hold them as hostage, but then secondly send them back to be locals ruling the local government with the heart of Babylon. In this case, but we've already learned that in the process, they faced some challenges. Would they compromise their faith? Would they compromise their morals and convictions? We saw Daniel and his friends standing firm, even in the issues of biblical diet that were required in the Mosaic Law. In Daniel chapter 2, we saw how God gave great enabling, specifically to Daniel, but to all four as they prayed together and were able to answer questions. All the wise men of the great wisdom capital, Babylon, couldn't answer because they couldn't tell the king Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed as well as what it meant. But God did something amazing. He revealed the dream and its meaning to Daniel to make it very clear. Daniel was his man and Nebuchadnezzar noticed. Well, sometime later now, we come to Daniel chapter 3, another incident. Daniel is not directly involved in this incident, but his three friends are, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, their Hebrew names. And so I'm going to ask you to just look at your text as I read chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. We won't do the whole chapter, and I'll apologize now. There's lots of names in here. We'll see how I do. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you, the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego," those are their Babylonian names. "These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Well, we'll see where this goes. And, of course, you might remember this is the fiery furnace account that is quite an adventure. in God's plan. But we're going to more focus on just these early verses at this point. First of all, something of the background. Okay, we've seen that about 605, they are taken into captivity in Babylon. There were three exiles or three captivities, three phases to bringing Israel to Babylon. 605, the leadership, a large group of leadership in 597. And then in 586, Jerusalem's destroyed and just some peasants are left in the land. Well, where does this fit into the program? Probably the best way to understand it is about the time of 594 BC. During that time, between December 595 and January of 594 BC, are you getting these dates? These are very important. Maybe not. During the 10th year of his reign, during Nebuchadnezzar's 10th year, there was an attempted coup. Apparently, his army tried to rebel and take control. After the coup attempt failed, it's likely that this is what's going on. Now we're going to have a loyalty oath. So within his army, within his leadership party, if you will, but within the military, an attempt was made to take over the government. He dealt with that, and now he's going to summon all of his government officials and all of his subdued kings to come. And this is, I think, what's going on. This is like a loyalty oath. We are all going to bow. And this is kind of a recommittal. So he's kind of putting things back on track after this revolt. Here's what one of the texts said. In the 10th year, the king of Akkad was in his own land. From the month of Kislev to the month of Tevet, there was rebellion in Akkad. With arms, he slew many of his own army. His own hand captured his enemy. That's actually a Babylonian historical chronological account. So you see the dates. You see the year there is 595 to 594. There was a rebellion, it says, in his military. With his own arm, he slew many of his own army. That suggests that he actually had to take up arms. I mean, there was a pitched battle. And it's interesting, some of these events don't show up in their chronological tables. They don't, especially if when they lose a battle, those often don't get into the record. But here there was a rebellion and he was with his own arm, it says. So he must have, he must have taken up arms and led a counter attack and fought off his own military. So this must have been quite a season. And when are we talking? 595-ish. So Daniel has been there for about 10 years. So he's young mid-20s. He was, remember, head over Babylon. So he and these others who were also high officials in the Babylonian province were there during an attempted overthrow of the government. When I read this, I have to remember, I don't know if you've ever seen, you can find sometimes the copies of this video. There was a time when Saddam Hussein kind of solidified his control over Iraq. I don't know if you've ever seen this video. It's kind of chilling. There's a meeting of the parliament, and he comes in smoking his cigar, and he gets up and he announces there has been rebellion and conspiracy among us. Some among us have rebelled against us. And while he is up there, he starts reading names. And as he reads the names, some soldiers come in and escort the person out. It is the most chilling thing. He just right there, he stages. And I don't know if there was a conspiracy or if he just knows who's not really his greatest supporter. But he does. It's a house cleaning of the parliament. And it's amazing. After a while, you look out of the parliament and various of these leaders are weeping because they know they could be next. They're all just waiting, sweating and crying. Is he going to call my name next? Because the name's called. In come the soldiers. Out the person goes. Next name's called. All of a sudden, some start, rising up and chanting, basically, hey, Saddam's the greatest, Saddam's the greatest, hoping somehow they won't get called. But that reminds me of, when I think of that, that's Iraq, that's Babylon. And matter of fact, Saddam Hussein's ambition was to be the next Nebuchadnezzar. Well, here Nebuchadnezzar had a revolt of his army. That's serious business. And he was enough of a commander that he could actually lead the response to that. He slew some of his own army, but it says he captured, with his own hand, he captured his enemy. And there's other accounts that seem to point to a trial and execution of the leader of the revolt. So that's something of the background. There has been political upheaval of the worst kind. We're not talking, you know, a Democrat administration is replaced by a Republican administration. We're talking stability of the nation. The king is under attack and is able to beat back the attack. And so this is kind of a scary time, finding out who the loyal ones are and who aren't. Do you kind of get the picture? And again, when I think of those images I've seen of Saddam Hussein, no one feels safe. Because all that has to happen is someone has to accuse you, and you're taken off to execution. That's what's going on, I think, historically. This is the best historical setting for this account. And we wouldn't have known some of these things until they discovered these chronological records. And so with that in view, he calls for a loyalty oath. As a matter of fact, I'll mention in just a bit, there's an intriguing, this is from an article from an Australian periodical, a journal. This intriguing evidence comes to us in the form of an undated text from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. So here we have this undated, except it's from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. That pretty well narrows it down. Okay, so they didn't have newspaper dates. And he probably would have put on there, you know, 593 B.C., right? Think about that. It was written in five columns on the five sides of a clay prism. This prism was found at Babylon and now resides in the Istanbul Museum. The first three columns of this text are devoted to Nebuchadnezzar's relations with the gods. The last two columns contain a list of more than 50 officials of various ranks whom Nebuchadnezzar appointed. So what's really interesting is here's this clay prism. I don't want to call it a tablet because it's multi-sided. There's three columns that talk all about his religious fervor, if you will. And then there's a couple of columns with a long list of government officials that he has appointed. So this is kind of the remaking, I think, of the cabinet and the government. You get the picture? It's a time of instability and uncertainty. Who stands with me? That's the background when he says, I have an idea. We're going to have a ceremony. And he makes it glorious. So the man is a great leader of his time. First, he is able to lead a military defense that conquered the rebels. That's pretty impressive. But secondly, he knows how to gather the masses. And he builds this huge golden image. It's 60 cubits by 6 cubits. Now, there's a word to describe the mathematical system of the Babylonians. Most of us use a decimal system. The hyper geeks among us use a binary system, ones and zeros. But we use 1 to 10 as our system. The Babylonians used a six digit system, sexagimal or something. I'm not sure what it's called, but it's not decimal. So it's interesting. This thing was 60 cubits by 6. It fits with their mathematical norms. Now, what's a cubit? Do you remember? Yeah, it's the distance between your elbow and the tip of your fingers. Typically, think 18 inches, a foot and a half. So 60 cubits, pull out your smartphone. 60 times 1.5 is 90 feet tall by about 9 feet wide. Now, if you think about it, I always hate doing it. I don't know why we do this on a Sunday evening. I hope you got your nap in. That's a 10-to-1 ratio, right? Does that sound like the normal human body? No. Can I give you some information? Leonardo da Vinci, you know, is one who studied the human body and art and all that. In his diagram of the human body and what are the right best proportions, he said the distance across the shoulders should be no more than 25%. The maximum should be 25% of the height of the body. So width, so there, that's a 4-to-1 ratio. Are you with me? Is that too much math? I've got a couple of mathematicians here sticking with me, and the rest are, what's he talking about? So I said the statue was 10-to-1. The normal would be maybe 4-to-1. A couple things to think. Actually, archaeologically, it says this happened in the plain of Dura, in a place that's associated with the name of Dura. They have found a large mound that the archaeologist says must have held some colossal image on it. And it's 20 feet high. So that reduces something. And often the images, and I have here, maybe Wednesday I'll show you. I have a picture of a Babylonian statue from the time. You can see it's got a pretty tall hat on it. That didn't help at all, did it? But figure your foot, we're looking at more like a 6-to-1 or something, still not the 4-to-1. But I think it was probably looking in a human form. Now the question is, of what person or what, who did it represent? Two possibilities. It could have been the Babylonian god Marduk. Or I kind of lean towards it was Nebuchadnezzar himself. Okay. It was gold. Now that doesn't mean it was solid gold. A 90 foot by 9 foot structure of solid gold would be an enormous undertaking to make it, and the cost and value. But it was very common back then to plate things with gold. And so that's it was, but either way, it must have been the most incredible. Can you imagine in the Mediterranean sun, this 90-foot structure, let's say 70 foot if it's up on that platform, unless it was black gold also. It must have been the most incredible picture. Now, where in the world did he get up the idea of representing his government's unity and strength with a gold image? Were you here for chapter 2? Remember the dream? It was an image. It was a human form image. Head, arms, legs, feet are all described. And the head was gold, remember? Then silver, bronze, iron and clay. And that gold head was Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. So what I'm suggesting is, and that was a few years, that was early in his reign. This is a few years later, less than 10 years later, when he wants to put up something that will make an impressive display of the Babylonian Empire in glory, what does he do? A golden image. All gold, because he's representing just the Babylonian phase, and that's why I'm suggesting it's probably a picture of himself. Maybe a little out of proportion, but to make himself look more impressive, there it is. This is, in a sense, it represents the glory of Babylon. And then, again, he's a master orchestrator because he brings in the orchestra. So think about this man as a leader. He's a military giant who can fight off, who can conquer nations. He has raised Babylon to the strongest, to the leader of the world. He's able to put down a battle from his own army, who must have been pretty good. And now he knows how to bring the people together. Here's this magnificent golden image. I mean, you see something that big in gold, it must have just been stunning. It must have been amazing. It must have been awesome. What a great government that can do this, that has the wealth and power. And then he makes it a great performance. He brings in the huge orchestra. And there's this list of all these things. Again, when my mind is going back to those historical videos of, have you ever seen the great meetings that Hitler would bring together, and they would orchestrate these things to just work up a furor and a fervor. I mean, they had it so exacting that when they had the army standing together, you know, they were, it was all set so perfectly by height. Everything was, it moved people. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. This huge image to draw people together. And so notice how it works out. He brings them together. He assembles all the military. Again, now my mind is back to Saddam Hussein, and here's the parliament. He gathers all these people, and we kept reading it, and I think we're supposed to be impressed. He didn't just bring together a cabinet of about a dozen people. He brought in the whole government. Everybody's there. But you might have noticed, if we get later on in the chapter, there's one person who's very significant who's missing. Daniel's not here. Why isn't Daniel here? And there's all kinds of theories. He was sick. He was traveling. He knew what was coming. Some have suggested he was there, but he had so much power the Chaldeans didn't want to risk putting him on the line. I like the suggestion that's made, is that in view of this historical event, Daniel was so close to the king that his loyalty was beyond question. And so Nebuchadnezzar said to him, Daniel, you don't need to come. I know you're with me. But I'm trying to get a hold of these other people. So it could be he was given a leave of absence just because his loyalty was beyond question. Now, when I meet Daniel in heaven, if he tells me it's something different, I'll humble myself and say, okay, I got it wrong. But I like that answer best. Well, actually, probably the best answer is one commentator who said, we don't know and we shouldn't try and figure it out. There's a lot of wisdom in that. But Daniel wasn't there, maybe because of his loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar. But notice how did you notice the list is kind of exhausted? How it keeps repeating the same list. What it's saying is, this must have been incredible. This vast field filled with the most powerful and influential people of the most powerful and influential empire. Now, I don't follow these things very carefully. Every once in a while, I'll hear little things, you know, like the Oscars and some of these other great movie or whatever entertainment things. And it's a big deal who shows up, I guess. And I gather it's a big deal what they're wearing. You know, well, this is really important. Now, we might have earthquakes in other parts of the world where thousands are dying, but what really matters is just what kind of a dress was so-and-so wearing. Well, I don't follow that stuff. Most of the time when I hear this stuff on the news, I don't even know who the people are. But people are impressed. Well, this must have been an incredible meeting. And that's why I think we're supposed to get, this must have been an incredible gathering of the most powerful and influential people in the world, unparalleled, summoned by the power and authority of Nebuchadnezzar, show up in the field of Dura. We're having a meeting. So here's that they arrive. Can you imagine when they came in? Here's this 90-foot gold structure. Oh, the awes. And then the orchestra that was gathered. First of all these various authorities and leaders. And then he declares, then the herald announces, to you the command is given, O peoples of nations, men of every language. In other words, just like Daniel and his friends, there were all kinds of nationalities and ethnicities that were there as servants of the empire. And he says, if the moment you hear, and this is so perfectly orchestrated, when the music starts, you will bow. It must have been, again, awe-inspiring as this incredible music begins. And the Babylonians were known for being very musical. Just off the top, you might remember in the Psalms, it said that when the Babylonian or when the Hebrew exiles were being brought, the Babylonians said, sing us some of your songs. How can we sing the songs of Zion here in captivity? But it was, they were very much into music. So as the music starts, it was all massively orchestrated. It must have looked like a field in Kansas as the wind blows across and all the wheat just all at the same time bows. It must have been stunning. At the moment you hear the music, and again, we're told not only is it an impressive gathering of the elite, it was an impressive orchestra. All these things are here, the horn, flute, lyre, trigon. So the first couple are wind instruments, and then there's stringed instruments, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery. Then there's the bagpipe. I don't know what you call a bagpipe. I heard a bagpipe again recently at a memorial service, and I was reminded of the question, how in the world do you even know if a bagpipe is out of tune? It's a strange instrument. But I don't think that's what this was. I think the best understanding of the language, due to basic newer information, is it was some kind of a drum-type device, a percussion device, not a bagpipe. All kinds of music. So this was a huge, like I said, it was beautifully orchestrated. The music starts. When you hear that, you are to fall down and worship the golden image. You remember when Nebuchadnezzar was impressed with Daniel's God? When Daniel could tell him what he dreamed and what he meant, and it just pierced straight to the heart of Nebuchadnezzar and said, "You are right. Not only is that what I dreamed, I can believe that's exactly. And you're telling me your God knows my dream, has revealed his truth to me, and he's told me that of the coming world empires, he fell before Daniel to honor Daniel's God. And he's calling on these people to fall before this image, to honor him, Babylon, and the gods of Babylon, Marduk in particular. Whoever doesn't gets thrown into the furnace. And the story will develop later on that. Just interestingly, and I think I might have forgotten my dates, but somewhere in the 1600s or 1700s, we have record of someone visiting this region, and indeed there were furnaces that were kept burning for the execution of people that charged too much for the food. I guess one of the problems sometimes when you're dealing with political issues is if people are price gouging and the peasants can't eat. So the rulers had a great answer for that. If you overcharge, you'll be overcooked. But just, in other words, in this region, there was this history of furnaces for execution. And so there it is. For this reason, at that time, so they did it. And again, it must have been the most incredible event. Moving, inspiring. And what a response. Yes, there was disruption. That's all done. We are together, aren't we? And so as every official bowed, three stood out like a sore thumb. Can you just imagine as you looked out over the impressiveness of the field, those three probably were standing together, standing good straight back, listening to the music. I'll just mention, I won't get into it. Notice how we talked about all those different governing officials on this prism that was had all these texts. It's interesting. There are it has a long list of various types of officials and officials' names. The court officials, and I won't even try and read all these. Just one, for example, Nabuzeri-Idinam or something. And all these different names those are the court officials, and there's like 18 names. There were officials of the land of Akkad, then there's like 11 names. There were officials of the towns, and there's 11 names. There were district officials, 9 names. There were western vassal kings and several. And by the way, the tablets are incomplete. And these are just some that it says he was appointing. So again, we've had a cleaning of house. Nebuchadnezzar appointed these. I just think it's interesting, by the way, excuse me, that there were some names that might strike us as interesting in this context. Let's see if I can find them real quickly. Listen to these names. One of them was named Mushalim Marduk. Remember, one of our Hebrew characters is Meshach. There was another one, Ardi Nabu, which kind of sounds like Ebed-Nego or Abednego. Hanunu, kind of sounds like Hananiah. The scholar I was reading, he thinks that very well could be the three Hebrew young men are specifically named on this prism as being brought into authority. So moving on, what's happened? So these three are there. They refuse to bow. some Chaldeans. Remember, those were the wise men of Babylon. These were the local wise men who were made to look bad before Nebuchadnezzar by Daniel and these three men, who watched these three foreigners, young, novices, foreigners, Jews, being exalted to some of the greatest positions of authority in the land. And now we have grounds to attack them. And they bring them before the king. And they start off with, "King, didn't you give us an order, King? This is your command. This is your authority. You were the one that was threatened by the rebellion. You have given an order. And we would like to ask you a question. Didn't you say everyone was supposed to bow?" "Well, there are certain Jews, no, it's foreigners, whom you have appointed over the administrations of the province of Babylon. You have been so kind to them. You gave them that high authority, even though they were foreigners. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men, O king, have disregarded you. They have dishonored you. They have disobeyed you. They are resisting and rebelling against your authority, king." At a time like this, can you go back to the Saddam Hussein parliament I saw? Can you imagine if someone walked out and pointed to three guys and said, "Look, those three aren't doing what you told them to do"? For those three, it would have been over. Well, they come up and said, "Look, you commanded. You gave them every opportunity, these foreigners. And this is how they treat you. They are disobeying directly your command. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods." That's true. "Or worship the golden image which you have set." Well, I'll just read the next couple of words, and you know where this goes. "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and anger, gave orders." Well, we'll find out what happens to these three, but having set up the background, understanding the significance of the event, I want us to notice these three men. A couple of things to quickly just call to your attention. Notice their courage and conviction. Remember back when they were, "Will you eat unbiblical foods?" "No, we won't." How did they deal with that? They respectfully appealed, first to a higher authority, then to the lower guy. "How about, can we just do a test? What is your real goal? Your goal is that we are healthy and able to serve the king. Give us a test. Let us eat what we eat for 10 days and see how we look. Can we work out an understanding?" So there were men of conviction, but they could negotiate. When it comes to bowing before this image and worshiping, there's no negotiating. And that's where I think we need to learn from them. Dare to be a Daniel who can have conviction and say, "I'm not going to compromise," and yet wisdom. Is there a way I can understand what you're trying to accomplish? But there come times when we have to say, there is no compromise. There is no other position. We will not worship an image. They didn't scream and yell. They didn't throw a fuss. I think they just, my guess and my impression is, with dignity, they just stood while everyone else bowed. Now, they're going to face consequences for that, and they know those consequences. This was a time, these were people that were brutal in their executions. They knew the king meant full well what he said. They had just seen him survive an upheaval. But in the midst of the political upheaval, with their lives on the line, these three young men in their 20s have the courage and convictions to say, there is no other way. Worshipping an image isn't on the table. We cannot. We will not. Bow. One of the reasons I want to be studying the book of Daniel is because I feel that there are lessons in where Daniel was and his time in history that speaks to us. We face challenges as our culture is increasingly growing hostile to a biblical faith. Seems like in this day, the great issue is, the spearhead of the issue is on the moral plane. But on the basis of the moral plane, attacking the essence of our faith and the biblical standard. But we are in a time of great, growing political, social, moral upheaval. What will we do when we're called to bow, to bend our knee out of loyalty to the system? Will we have the courage to say, I can't do that? First of all, it takes the wisdom to know, where is that line? Is it wrong to pay taxes? Well, Jesus gave us clear instruction on that. I may not take delight in sending in my tax check, but Jesus said, pay your taxes, so I'm going to send in my tax check. But where is the line where we're going to be called to say, do this or face the consequences? In recent days, we've heard about different ones, where especially it seems in the area of the same-sex marriage issue. You know, you've heard of the baker. We want you to, these were regular customers and they had no problem selling them cookies and pastries and whatever it may be. But we want you to bake us a cake that celebrates an abomination. That's not how they put it, but that's how it was heard. You're asking us to bow. We can't do that. We care for you as people. We like you as customers, but you're asking us to celebrate something that's outside of our convictions. We can't do that. So the government steps in and says, you will, or we will fine you. And they say, well, that doesn't change anything. We won't. And so the last word I heard is, I think the fine is $135,000 out of business. They've lost the business they've built up because the government says, you will do this. And their answer is, we can't do this. You know, there are times when you try and walk through and say, well, can we work out a way around this? What is it you're really trying to accomplish? Can we do this? Can we do this? But I believe these bakers have been a people of character and I think correct position saying we can't do this. And if we lose our business, then we lose our business. I'm reminded of John Bunyan as we're thinking about the Puritans in our adult Sunday school class. And, you know, his story, you know, remember, he's the one who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. Remember, he was arrested for the crime of preaching the gospel, having a religious meeting. Sheriff shows up. He's preaching to a group of people in a barn. And he comes in and says, there's no threat. There's not a weapon in the house. This isn't a great. He says, so he takes him to jail. But he says, you know, look, John, Mr. Bunyan, here's what we'll do. All you have to do is tell me you'll stop this preaching. And I'll let you go. You have to go home. Your wife needs you. Your children need you. Your little daughter, your little blind daughter needs you. Just tell me you won't preach anymore. You're a tinker. You fix broken pots. Go back to your business. Forget this preaching. I'll let you go. And John Bunyan says, well, if you were to let me go tonight, tomorrow, I'll be preaching. I'm called of God to preach the gospel. I can do no other. That's why he spent 12 years in prison. And he saw and struggled deeply to see how his family needed him. And he did what he could. You remember, he made shoelaces to sell in prison so he could try and send some money home to care for his little blind daughter. But if the choice is follow Christ or follow my government, may God give me the courage to recognize where the absolute issues are, and respond with absolute conviction and courage, and be like these three who could say, whatever comes, I must obey the higher authority. What a way to end, but it reminds me of a hot dog commercial from my youth. Did you see it when you were growing up, some of you old folks? Hebrew National hot dogs. They talked about how the United States government had all these rules for what could and couldn't be in hot dogs. And then, with some glorious music in the background, they showed the sunrise in the distance that said, "But we at Hebrew National respond to a higher authority. And so ours are the best hot dogs because we don't meet government standards. We meet God's standards for our hot dogs," is what they were saying. It's a silly comparison. But that's where we need to be. Respect for authority. Honoring our leaders. But when the challenge comes where we are put in a direct choice, whom will we obey? May God give us the wisdom to know when that time is, what the issues are, and the courage to not even waver. In my imagination, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't do a quick huddle and say, "Do we bow or not bow?" I think they all knew what to do. The music started, and they stood tall. We'll get to the consequences of that action later. But may God give us the courage to recognize the issues and know when it's no longer time to discuss, to negotiate, but to stand. As we prayed this morning again for Pastor Saeed in prison in Iran, they've made it very clear. You don't have to stay in prison. You don't have to be separated from your family. You don't have to go through these beatings and the very likelihood that you will die because he's been through these treatments. All you have to do is deny Christ. And you are free. And he realizes there is no negotiating. There is no discussion. If that's the issue, he cannot go free. Do we have that conviction? That courage? That discernment? May God give us the grace. And may God give grace to this next generation, where I think the challenges will be stronger. May we raise up a generation of Daniels. Strong spines for the day. Our Father, we thank you for these three who model for us and challenge us with their conviction and courage. Lord, I thank you for the clarity of their understanding of your word so that they knew when the issue was beyond compromise. And with simplicity and with humility and with grace, they stood firm. Father, I pray for those in our land who have been through that process, losing businesses, losing positions, because they've stood firm. And Father, I think of those who have lost their freedom across the world today because they've stood firm. And we think of those, Father, who have lost their very lives in places like North Korea because they stood firm. Lord, in our day, when our time comes, grant that we will have the courage and the conviction to stand tall in humble service of Jesus Christ. We pray this in the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.